For being here, we have passed out a sheet with a number of events that the Brozzi Center is sponsoring this semester. As you can see, we'll have a busy semester. I hope you'll join us for a lot of these things. We provide food for all the lunches and some of the other things, so you can do double duty. I'll just highlight the next two couple things that are coming up. One is a lunchtime conversation in 2 weeks on Tuesday with Megan Sweeney, a beloved member of our theology department here, talking about the Pulse program that she runs and about service learning in general. And then the next day, we have a terrific political theologian from Villanova now, formerly of Syracuse, speaking about his new book on Black Natural Law. And Craig here will be one of the respondents, and Vince Rougeau, Dean of the Law School, will also be responding. That'll be a little unusual. We'll have it in this room, and it'll be a two-hour session rather than an hour and 15 minutes to give us a little more time and a little more depth on the topic. And then, as you can see, we just have a ton of other great things going on. I'll also highlight, for those of you who are faculty, and everybody here, actually, on September 28th, we have a very student-oriented conversation that's going to be more of a town hall-type event, featuring a panel of students and a room full of students, we hope, talking about millennials and their sort of toxic political discourse that's going on, how we square that with ethics, with the Jesuit principles, with concern about civility, but also righteous anger and prophetic witness and all the sorts of things that are going on today. So I hope you'll help us spread the word on that. If you could turn off the ringers on your cell phones before we get started. With that, I'll introduce our speaker. Liz Mock is a Mary Knoll lay missioner, born and raised in Minnesota. After receiving her nursing degree, she joined the newly formed Mary Knoll Catholic Lay Mission Program and was sent to Tanzania, where she has spent 40 years working in maternal and child health care and advocating for the rights of women and girls in Eastern Africa. She presently works in the Catholic Diocese of Musoma's Planning and Development Directorate, where she coordinates its health, education, and social services. The directorate has a strong program to end all forms of gender-based violence, including female genital mutilation, child marriages, and sex trafficking. And the diocese advocates through shelters, schooling, and training seminars on the legal rights of women. We're delighted that we could host Liz today while she's in the United States for a couple weeks on break and the restoration, but also conversation. She had a terrific lecture I heard last night with almost 100 people showed up. This is a more intimate affair, so we can be more casual. But please join me in welcoming Liz Mock. Hi, we've got food, Carrie. We've got food in the other room.
Carrie, you're right here.
Please.
You sure?
Yeah.
Well, after you speak, we'll introduce ourselves so that you know who you're who you're dealing with
really?
With questions.
Okay.
Would you rather do it?
No, let's go through.
Would you rather do it beforehand?
Yeah.
All right, great. Steve, why don't you start us off?
I teach moral theology at Boston College. Oh, I should tell them. You know that. I'm Steve Pope. I teach moral theology at BC. And Liz is a friend of mine. I'm really glad she's here.
My name is Craig. I'm learning to teach moral theology at Boston College. I'm a grad student. And,
I'm Marianne Lockery at the Center for Human Rights and International Justice and Social Work.
I'm Dominic. I'm a senior theology major, and I took a course called Women and Gender in Islam for comparative theology last semester, so I thought this would be interesting.
Perfect. Yeah. I'm Tom. I'm the graduate student, research student this year for the Boise Center, and I'm finishing up my PhD in theology.
I'm Ryan. I'm a senior, undergraduate senior, and I'm an undergraduate research assistant here.
I'm Omid, also a junior undergraduate research assistant here at the Boise Center.
I'm Sarah Hood. I work in the School of Social Work.
Eileen Eyrig, also in the School of Social Work.
Ethel Charker, again, former counselor to Somali kids in Boston Public Schools.
I'm Suzanne Pavlone, and I'm the events programmer here.
Andrea Vicini, I teach at the School of Theology Ministry, Moral Theology.
And I am Carrie Crennan. I work at the Lonergan Institute, which is connected to the philosophy of theology.
We did look in on you. And she teaches a cult class on philosophy and theology to freshmen that have created many disciples. She has many disciples here at BC.
Beloved fans.
Yes.
Right. So welcome.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. It always helps to know a little bit about your audience. I have my notes here, and I kind of will follow them just because I can get off on every tangent in the book and start telling stories and stuff. So And I wanted to make sure I leave enough space for you, you know, to have reaction and comment to. So first of all, I'd just like to say I bring greetings from our children who have been subjected to both FGM and those sold into child marriages. That's a really important thing to do in Tanzania. We bring greetings, and I know that when I leave here, I will take your greetings back to them. And then they know that there is solidarity with them. So we're in the Diocese of Musoma. It's the northwestern part of Tanzania. And most of what I'm going to say is just coming from my own experience of working with these children. I am a nurse, and I went out to Tanzania many years ago to do maternal child health. It wasn't to work in this area, but this is where my life has led me. This is my what I do working with these kids is what I do for my side job. My day job is I work for the Bishop of Musoma. But this all comes under it, so it's helpful. So 40 years ago, I ended up in Africa as a young nurse and a missioner who knew little about the issues that we're facing in the world, that women were facing. So I had been through one woman. I had helped one woman in the United States for labor and delivery, and I ended up going out to Africa and doing labor and delivery. So it was a very steep learning curve for me, but I was quickly trained. My first five women, I had two of the biggest babies the clinic delivered that year, and three had the cord wrapped around their neck. It was probably my neck too, but their neck. And I was scared to death. It was really a baptism by fire. So my father passed now, but he was a family doctor, and he actually wrote to me a letter early on in those first years and asked me if I had malpractice insurance. I just kind of laughed and said, "No, Dad, don't worry about it." I think I was too scared to know. But it was really the beginning of a lifelong commitment for me to the women in Africa. So one of my first deliveries that I ever did was a Muslim woman who we could not get to deliver, and we were about 50 kilometers away from any help. So we threw her in the back of an open-air pickup truck. My friend Mary drove the truck, and I was in the back kind of just holding her, talking to her, and we couldn't get the baby out, so I was praying. But all I could get through was, "Hail Mary, Hail Mary, Hail Mary, Hail Mary." I couldn't go any farther. I couldn't remember any of the rest of the prayer. But I thought, okay, if I just keep saying Hail Mary, maybe God's going to hear me, right? So after about 10, 15 miles down the road, the corrugations of the road knocked the baby out and brought the baby out. It was a normal delivery after that. So we got this baby, and we had a safe delivery, and her statement to me at the end of it, which is, I think, the thing that I've carried in my heart all the time, is she said, "You were praying to your God for me, and your God really listens to you." Mm-hmm. And I have to say, in 40 years of working, I really have been through some traumatizing times and everything, but I do feel that all through that, God has listened, and I felt that presence. I learned many things about women's reproductive health care in those beginning years. I learned, as most of you already know, and everything you've read and researched, is that women do most of the work in Africa. You know, it's all the child care, carrying water, farming, searching for wood to cook with. We all know those stories. But I was living it. I was in the reality of it. I was, and it was new to me, and I was overwhelmed. I was overwhelmed with the way women were treated. It was horrible to see some of the things we saw. And they had very little help from outside. And then when it came to their delivery, they didn't have the right to make any decision as to whether they wanted to go to a health center for delivery or not. That was made by the woman's husband or the mother-in-law. So they didn't have that choice. So in reality, 23 women die daily in Tanzania, and that's today, from birth-related complications. We're still losing that. So think about it. That's almost one an hour. It's 161 a week and on to 7,000 something, you know. So let's fast forward now to 40 years later and where we are. Right now what we're dealing with is many complex, harmful traditions, which include FGM and child marriages. They're not new issues for us, but they're issues that are finally coming out from behind a veil. They're things that have been happening traditionally for a long, long time, but we never talked about them. You know, think back to your own lives, the secrecy of some of your own family traditions and that. In Africa, that's what it was. If a woman was undergoing circumcision, it was a quiet thing off to the side. If a girl was sold off, she was sold off, gone. So they're hidden away, and it's for like things like FGM, it was considered a rite of passage for the girls, and it still is. They have to go through that to become a woman. If she doesn't, she's never considered marriageable age. And then she's always going to stay at the child level. So this means that things like in a traditional culture for her, one of the biggest is whether or not she can touch and work with family cows, as she cannot use the gate to enter into the cows until she goes through the FGM. So if she can't take care of the cows in that traditional culture, what use is she? And it comes down to that completely. So FGM is a rite of passage for a young woman in the diocese. To just understand it better, 23 of 31 of our parishes in the diocese have FGM being done. And it's a pastoral issue for us, and it was addressed at our first synod, which we held in 2014. And we actually had a couple women speakers that are working in the diocese on it get up in front of the 250-plus people that were at the synod and actually talk about it. And many, think about it, 23 out of 31 parishes. We had a lot of people from all those parishes. So our bishop began his challenge in 2008. And he was sitting at Mass, probably up on a little bit of a stage, and he had an American priest on one side and an African priest on the other. And they had been working up there forever. They were very comfortable with all the traditions up there. And just before he heads out to give the homily, he turns to the priest and says, I think it's time that we say no to this for FGM for women. And I think the two priests nearly fell off their chairs. They were stunned. You can't really say no to a priest right away, so they just said, oh, yes, bishop, or to a bishop, yes, bishop, yes, bishop. And he got up and he looked at the elders, and in a very nice way he said, we have to end this. And it absolutely blew everybody's mind, because we've never had a bishop that took it on like that. So that was the beginning. Once he did it, then the rest of us can do it. So that really is what opened it up. So it's really the church. I'm just going to give you a little bit about FGM and what it is and how we're doing it. It's the partial or total removal of the external female genitalia. And in our area, that means they're taking the clitoris and the labia major and minor. And what they aren't doing is sewing it shut as in pharynx. So it's still very much filled with scar tissue at a time that a woman's going to be giving birth. It's done from birth to 18 years of age in our diocese. It's very common. It's one form of gender-based violence. And women who undergo this are at greater risk at all points. And so people that are working with the migrant women coming in, if they've got it. There was research in 2006, 28,000 women in six countries. The World Health Organization looked at it. And they said, and they could completely and verify that women will have an issue reproductively for the rest of their lives. And that means from the basics of having sex all the way to delivery and into their senior years, they will have problems. And it was the first time it was really proven. Before that, it was always anecdotal for us. So they're greater risk for obstetric fistula, which is maternal morbidity, the women that leak urine. It's done for a lot of reasons, but it is not Islamic and it is not Christian. People want to say it's one of those two things, and it is not. It is, and I would be very strong, it's both either cultural and it's control of women. A woman is unable to sit here and look at the men in this room without wanting to have sex with all of you. That's basically what it comes down to. Our cutting season is November and December each year. It's called forth by the elders. Boys are circumcised at the same time. You form a cohort. And once a girl is cut, she's marriageable age. She's ready. So our cutting is done between 13 and 15 years of age. So that schooling ends, they go into early marriages, and not just child. Child marriages is another thing. This is early marriages. And early pregnancy is a result of much, and she's not ready for delivery. It has been known that if she's not cut, she's forbidden to marry a member of the culture, though we're working to change that by working with men's groups. Pascalia was a young girl that was told by her father that she had to go under FGM, and she knew that it meant the end of all of her schooling and that she'd soon be married off. So she made it to the bus stand in Musoma, which is a little ways out of town, but at that point was left alone there and had no idea where she was going. And it meant that most likely she was facing rape that night of all the men that are in the bus stand, and then the beginning of prostitution for her. I mean, that would have been the outcome. So We have counselors that go out to the bus stand and are watching for these kids because they know that, you know, there's obviously a look with them that they're lost. And Peter, one of our older ones, was out there, and he got her into the shelter right away that we have. And she's with us. She's protected with us. We do not let her family know where she is so that they come and try to take her back out for FGM, which is what they'll do. So she's under protection with us, and the police are protecting her also. So we have to do that with a lot of our kids. Signs of hope with it. We have a rescue camp during the cutting season every year. Last year was 650 girls under armed guard. We have a year-round shelter called Jipe Moyo. Means give heart, and we have both boys and girls in the shelter. We have a safe circumcision camp for boys. We want to work with that cohort of boys that are at that same age and teach them about gender-based violence and then get them to stand with us, and it really does work. But they also have a safe circumcision at the end of it. We're doing training and seminars. I'd like to say just a little bit about child marriages. It's deeply embedded in the Tanzanian society. And in Tanzania, we have one of the highest pregnancy and birth rates in the world. It's a way of securing financial security through the paying of the dowry. So a girl receives, the parents receive the cows or the money for the dowry, and then that in turn is used for the young boys in the family to buy a wife. So if the girl doesn't get sold, the boys aren't going to marry. So you got to get the balance and all that. Two out of five girls in Tanzania are married before their 18th birthday. And most young women, 23% of our young women between the ages of 15 and 19 have already begun childbearing. So Pendo is a young girl who was 8 years old when she was sold into marriage. And after 2 weeks of trauma, and really that's rape, she was assisted by a young woman who met her out on the pathway and saw her. And Pendo said, I cannot stay here. And this woman said, just go back in the house, I'll come back tonight. And she had been trained that we cannot take a child because we would be kidnapping. So we have to be very careful of how we approach this. So the young woman brought back the police that night, and the man said, oh, no, you've misunderstood this. She is my house girl, no problem. And little Pendo at 8 years old, just in her own, she just looks at him and she says, but you call me your wife. And that's how they could prove it was child marriage. And he had told her that many, many times. You are my wife now. So she's 10 now. She's 2 years later. We've had to deal with a lot of trauma. We've had to deal with a lot of medical. The genital area was, she was raped continuously. So, but today she's at our shelter. She can read and write. She's going to school. And she can play as a child. So, you know, for us it worked. The husband was 55 years old and he was sentenced to 30 years in jail. So we were able to do the whole thing. Bokeh is another one of my favorites. And this is a very common story, again, that we're hearing over and over again. She's now 14 years old. When she was 5 years old, her father began to use her sexually. And so social welfare moved in after years of abuse and brought her to our shelter. And we have a great nun running the shelter named Annunziata Chacha. Love that name. And when Bokeh arrived, she'd never been to school. She couldn't read and write. She's been in the shelter now for 2 years. She's reading, writing, and learning. And she still has difficulties in the genital area. We're still having to work even 2 years later. So signs of hope with it. It's against the law in Tanzania, but it's difficult to enforce, as is FGM. They're both against the law, but it's very difficult to enforce. We have greater awareness because we're talking about it. We have the shelter. We have counseling. The Tanzanian media is more open and talking about it in public, so it's better, you know, get the word out there. We have new parliament provisions that make it illegal for girls in primary and secondary school to marry. So if a girl is in primary or secondary, she has to stay. And now we just need to learn how to follow that up better to make sure that they don't slip out. So we're working at changing attitudes and customs. So we do seminars, media, print, radio, TV. We're continuing to get the story out so that the veil of secrecy is torn apart and people can't hide behind that. I have been asked many times why I interfere in these traditions, especially as a white woman. And I just would like to say I work with a local African church, and they've taken it on. Everyone I work with is Tanzanian. I'm the only one working in all of that. I see myself as an advocate, I see myself as a grant writer, and I see myself as a humanitarian, just trying to help these girls get more respect. I do not go beyond what the diocese is already doing and speaking, so our bishop and everybody. So we're working hard to make these changes so that the girl child will be respected, have the right to education, have the right to avoid early marriages, have the right to avoid early pregnancies. I really believe it can happen in my lifetime, because we're seeing so many signs of hope, and the veil is being torn away. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much. This is such a profound and profoundly troubling conversation to begin with, but thank you so much for your work and for telling us about it. Before we open it up to conversation, I guess I'd like to start with just a question of, I'm learning about all of this, and it's a nice surprise to know that there's a legal framework that's mm-hmm. supporting your work there. And my initial question before we came in was, on what basis do you argue against these practices? Is it on the basis of women's complete dignity, or on a Christian vision of respect, or of Imago Dei, or on legal principles, or African philosophical principles? What kinds of arguments do you make, and what do you find to be most effective in moving respect for women forward?
When we try to go at it from a really legal way, we lose most of the people traditionally that don't have a lot of education. Mm-hmm. So, there's a Marriage Law Act, there's the Rights of Children Act, there's all these acts. There's a sexual act that we have in Tanzania, and in many parts of Africa they have all of these. If we try to use those, it doesn't mean anything to anyone. So we really go at it more from... this is a child of God, and we need to respect on that level, and they should have all the same rights and human rights that your boy child, and mm-hmm. But we're working against a lot of different things, like wife beating in the diocese where I am is very much accepted, so we need to get rid of that also, so that we get more respect for women across the board. So I'd say we do it more from respect.
Yeah, internal to the church, to the parish.
Yeah.
Great. What are the questions we have?
So what are you seeing as the responses of the women in the households, the mothers? Are they joining? Are they completely fearful?
There's a lot of fear. There definitely is. But we just did a baseline study that finished about 2 weeks ago. And the number one thing, 99% of those women that were interviewed for it all agreed that it has to end. There was one old lady that came out very strong. It has to continue because it happened to me. But we've really moved from where everyone was saying it has to continue to now we need to end it. But how do you end it? Does it go out slowly? Do we just get lesser and lesser? Or do we make a major effort and say, this is it? Now, when you do mutilation during that time, during that cutting season, it's a time of great celebration. It's a time when... the cutter gets money, the elders get money, everybody has these big parties, cows are killed, there's huge celebration, there's a huge rite of passage. So how do you, if you're going to, you don't want to just change society, you have to say, how do you figure out the rite of passage that's going to happen so that you can continue, but in a good way? And then we've really been working with some of the elders and people on that. Some of the cutters that come in, we're actually getting them to quit. And then, but at the same time, this is their livelihood. And if you don't help them, they're going to go right back to it. So we've been sending them to vocational schools and getting them to learn another trade so that you can say, no more of that, but you can now do this. And they can still support their family. So you just can't take everything away from people without bringing in another side of it.
Andrea, you're doing it.
Thank you for your presentation. I was just following up. My question is on what you had started to explain. In other contexts, for example, with rite of initiation, they replaced the rites of initiation of, that were violent and hurtful, in this case for men, with other celebrations, so with alternative ways in which they keep the celebration, they keep the rites of passage, mm-hmm. but that is not normal.
Right.
A threat for their health or their life. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, working within that cultural context, did you think or did you try some ways in which, if you think it is a way to go ahead, as you were saying, would be possible to keep the celebration, to keep the economic aspects of the rites of passage, but without harming the women.
Right.
And allow the women to have their own status within the society and not being outcast
right.
because they didn't go through the rites of passage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we're certainly working on it. There's a sister up in Kenya that has written a whole rite of passage. So we've sent our people up for training with her because they also do this in Kenya. So we've brought down some of those ideas and then tried to put them into the context of our area. So we do a rite of passage. It's a matter of whether they accept the rite of passage or not and say that that was enough. There are some people that say, rather than just stop the whole thing, you just make a tiny little superficial cut on the clitoris and say, then we've done the passage. We would argue against that. We're not going to do any form of cutting because who knows who's going to be doing that, first of all. But it's really the respect of the woman, because this is done in public. These girls are naked in front of everyone when it gets done. And if a girl dies during the circumcision or the mutilation, her body cannot be buried. And she is thrown out to the hyena.
Oh, my God.
So if that's the case, you have to say, from the Catholic Church, I believe in burial. I believe in resurrection. what am I doing to make sure that we respect the girls, both alive and dead? And so we want to be really careful. We don't go in to keep anything that's going to be negative, on the negative side. Yeah.
Yes, in the back, and then Marianne. Could you introduce yourself, please? I think you came in a little late.
Hi, sorry for being late.
No problem.
It's all right.
Not at all. I'm glad you're here. We had just introduced ourselves before you came in.
Sure. My name's JJ. I'm a senior here studying international studies, poli-sci track, and I'm really interested in this topic regarding child marriage. And my question is, I think the reason why GM was prevailed so long in Africa was part of associated with pride to women in Africa. So I know you have done a lot of work to bring up the awareness for the harmfulness of the practice, but how can you make sure that the subconsciously, the feelings related to honor does not come back in the society?
Yeah. It's a great question. It's a hard question for me. We're so focused on making sure that it ends because what it does. I would say our best way to do that is to educate the girl, and so that she's making her own choices, and that she has her rights and human rights. Because right now they don't when that's being done. I don't know if I'm answering that very well, but.
Yeah,
mm-hmm,
please.
Good, yeah.
I just think it's not like I don't have any sympathy for girls in Africa.
Yeah.
I've been in Tanzania before and I saw what they're going through. It's horrible. But at the same time, I would ask myself, am I imposing my own value on them?
Right. And that's why I say I work with the Catholic Church in Tanzania, and they're all Tanzanians. So this is not something I started or, I just work on that level. But I also work with all these girls. And they're asking for this. They are coming. We have 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds that are making decisions to leave home. It blows my mind. At 8, I wasn't making these decisions, But I look at it. They are really understanding that they have to protect themselves because no one else is going to protect them. And they come in, and that just kind of blows my mind. I just can't imagine some of our girls that you see on the street here having to make those decisions. At even 16, saying I'm not going to marry this person. So one of the important things for me is that we get the men and the boys on board with it. And when they're working together, those young men will marry girls that are not circumcised. And so therefore, you go into the next generation of people and it'll end. Because once I think the men are involved in it. And they are involved in the diocese with us.
Right.
Liz, my question's a little bit related to others in terms of how do you kind of make this practice institutionally sort of challenged? So I'm thinking, where are the other bishops? Where's the church? Where's East Africa? Like how, because if it starts, as I understand it, with a leader, how do we kind of get it so that it's kind of being perpetuated through church, perpetuated through East Africa, West Africa,
yeah.
et cetera?
Yeah. We need to move to that next step. And I've been trying to get my bishop, I have been pushing for a couple of years, he needs to write a pastoral on it.
Mm.
That'll get the church, you know, get it out there in the forefront.
Yeah.
And I keep saying, I'm writing with you. Would you just get
yeah.
your butt, sit down and write with me?
Yeah.
But we need. I think we definitely need to do that. The bishops that are over, there's only certain parts in Tanzania, and it's more over in the Arusha side, to Manyara and that area. They also do it. But over on our side of the country, our diocese is the only one. So really, when you look at the lake, we can't ask the other bishops right now to join with us because none of them have it being done in their area.
Right.
So we have to look with the ones in Arusha. So what we've started doing is, as a diocese and as our programs, we're connecting with people over in that area. And we're starting the way I think we should is at the grassroots and connecting.
Mm.
And we can then get up and start pushing those bishops once we get people on the ground there that...
But surely there's, if the bishops took it to another level about gender-based violence, it's happening everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
so,
you're right.
So,
yeah, we got to get those other bishops
yeah.
got it. Yeah, yeah. I have to say he talks about it in many places and tells what the diocese is doing, but I'm never at those bishops' meetings, which I wish I was, you know. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bethel.
How does the society treat the gentlemen who choose, the men who choose to marry these women who've been courageous? And if they do marry them, how is that, how are they treated? How are their children treated in the society?
Yeah, we're just kind of getting into that now. So the ones that have done it, it's good. They're probably going to have to move out of the area. And the reason why is if the girl is not mutilated already, when she comes to deliver her first baby, she will be mutilated on the delivery table. Whether she wants to or not. Because the mother-in-law, the aunt, the uncle, somebody's going to step in and say, do her, you know? So, yeah, and they'll take her to a local person for delivery and stuff and do it. So they really need to move out for at least delivery to protect it.
And then they move out, and then they have children. I mean, are they? How are they treated by the society?
It depends. I mean, it's a private area, so it's not something public that you see. So if nobody knows what they haven't done it, like if they go to another, if they move to another city, nobody knows they're not circumcised.
Okay.
So you can keep some of that quiet. They could say, I just had the little cut. They could do a lot of things to get around it. It's when they stay in their home area and everybody knows that that's the girl that grew up in that corral over there, you know, the cow farm over there. And she's not done.
To follow up on that, is there an urban-rural difference here?
Very much.
The city
would
be much more...
The city still does it. The
tolerant.
Girls still go home from the city. They get sent home to the grandparents if the family wants it done. So we probably do need to be going into more schools and speaking in outside of our area for girls that are circumcised.
Yeah, Tom.
What happens when, or what are your plans for when the girls become young women? So if they're at a shelter until they're no longer of the cutting age, traditionally, what happens?
That's
are they staying there forever?
No,
or,
gosh, no.
what do you plan on?
Yeah. We're educating them right now.
Okay.
And if they haven't been to school, then they will do some type of vocational school so they have some skill. If they're capable and can go on to university or our teacher's training or whatever, we will continue to look for funding to do that because it's going to be expensive, but it's something we're committed to. We do that. I don't know. Somebody kind of asked this question yesterday at some point, and I just started thinking about, do we set up a simple house for girls to live together until, you know, once they have to get out of the shelter, they're too old? I don't know, but it's a great, we have to start thinking.
I mean, it's a good problem to have.
Oh, yeah.
What do we do once we've succeeded?
Yeah.
What does that look like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Suzanne and then Carrie.
No, just quickly, I was interested when you said that the 55-year-old plus man who had married the 8-year-old was prosecuted and jailed. What are the repercussions legally for the fathers or the parents that then sell their child into marriage? Are there any repercussions?
Yeah, you have to find them. Yeah. Mm. Some of these kids are trafficked, so they're brought from other areas of the country. This little one came from way on the other side of the lake, Pendo. So going back and finding her family is very difficult, but we've heard that the parents were dead and that it was an uncle or a brother that sold her. So it's some of it's really hard to find, mm-hmm. and you have to figure out how much energy you have and people have to go back and dig these people up. But
where to invest your resources?
Yeah, when we're in the area and we can catch the ones that are right there.
Okay.
Yeah. Cell phones have made all the difference in the world. Mm-hmm. We give out our number all the time. We have a couple of Sister Chacha and Mama Regina do these seminars, and they hand out their number right and left. It's like writing in the bathroom here. You know? Mm-hmm. It's out there and. They get calls day and night from people, and they say, there's a woman being beaten in this village. What do we do? And we have a police gender desk in Musoma that we actually can call people on, and then they will send the police in that area because they can call from there and get the police. So, you know, we try to follow up as much as possible and get help when we can, but sometimes it's too late. You know, they've either really already really hurt the person or they've moved the person out.
Right.
I'm wondering, in terms of the FGM, is it commonly understood by people that it has religious connotations? Is it presented, is it perceived that way?
Not in our area, because it's not. It's social
right.
in our area. It's really a cultural thing.
Okay.
Very cultural.
So, and people understand it to be that way. Like, when you're trying
yeah.
to talk to families...
Yeah. You know, we work with everybody. We don't... and between our shelter and our seminars or whatever we're doing... It makes no difference what religion you are.
Right.
The ones that have done it the best are the Seventh-day Adventists. And I would say back about maybe 40, 50 years ago, they made a decision at one of their big meetings that they were not going to abide by this for their girls. And they just came out strong against it. And their girls are protected. They know they're Seventh-day Adventists. They don't touch them. You know, I want to say, how come we can't get the Catholics to say, you know, or the Muslim, or whoever, you know, the Lutheran, and get those churches to stand up and say, you can't do it. But, you know, it's very difficult for a bishop just to stand up and think everybody's going to follow him. And my bishop often tells me that. He says, Liz, I'm not God. I can't get everybody to do what I want. You know, I can stand up and say, I can try.
Not God can.
Yeah, it's true. So, but he's right. You know, if he said, any girl that's circumcised from now on, every you know, parents are going to jail or something, they wouldn't abide by that. You know, you have to bring people through a process to get to the point where they stand up and say no to it. So, and that's, I think, what we're in right now is a process. We're at the beginning of it. You know, we're early into it. We've got a lot of things in place, but we still have a heck of a lot of circumcision going on. And it actually is going underground for us. So we have to be very, very careful that we can keep getting into these areas and keep working with it.
Yes, Amit.
So aside from the church, have any other organizations assisted you, or maybe a Human Rights Watch exposed this further? Or how can,
yeah.
related to that, how can students really be activists on this and help?
Yeah, Human Rights is very much involved. All the churches in our area are involved at different levels, which is good. We you know, get people together and talking about it. Some churches are stronger. Some churches, I think, have better advocacy, and they know how to do it better. So some of them are not moving as strong, but the one of the Protestant churches has a really good shelter for girls out in another area that has a lot being done. I'm really thrilled now. I tend to go out there and just visit so that I show my support for them, even though, you know, coming from the Catholic, because I think that's the way you all work together and get something done. So. Students, I think it's certainly awareness, you know, and aware in the migrant population here in the United States. It's happening here. It's not just overseas. It's happening here. I come from Minnesota. We have the largest Somali group. Truly, I have spoken in classrooms where I have four girls in the burqa, you know, fully covered. One, I couldn't even see her eyes. It was unbelievable. You know, as I said last night, I pray before I start, I pray that they're open and that I'm open, that I can, whatever I say is not going to stop them from listening to me, and that when they ask the questions, can I be open to hearing their response to me? Because it's really frightening to stand up in front of a group like that and know that probably if they're all in that, they're probably circumcised, is my experience. So, yeah, it's just speaking here. It's coming to places like this and learning more.
Yeah. How do guys, you talk with men about this, and how do they see it?
In Africa or here?
Africa.
Oh, we do. They're all part of our group.
And they're in favor of stopping.
Yes. Yeah. Once people are educated, once people start hearing and realize what it is, we talk about the health consequences. We were sitting at a big seminar. We had an older man, and he sat through the whole seminar, and finally he said, I just don't understand what you're saying about that my wife could be hurting. You know, what? And we said, well, you know, tell us more. What does that mean to you? And he said, well, you know, she cries every time we have sex. And we said, all through all your years married? And he goes, yeah. And he says, am I hurting her every time? And we said, most likely. We said, what did it mean to you? He says, I thought she was happy. But no, she was hurting. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like that day it was like this light went on in his head, you know. So you just, that's the way you just, we have to keep bringing it up out there and talking about it and getting people on board.
Have you ever felt physically or psychologically threatened in the work that you do?
Not too much, because I usually travel with Tanzanians all the time. Mm-hmm. But if I drive through the area when it's being done, they're all on the road, I mean, hundreds of people, and they're most of the guys have chalk all over their faces, and they have knives this long. And they have spears and everything. So I never sit in the front seat. I don't want my face, you know, that's what they see. I sit off to the side and kind of, you know, sometimes kind of go like this, you know. But and they're usually smoking something. There's a little marijuana up there in that area, undergoing that. But it's really unbelievable to watch the girls walking home from it and the blood just dripping down their legs. And you see it. You see it. And they're... they are ready to fall over. And, you know, they're just encouraged to keep walking. And, you know, you're strong. You're a woman. Now you're a woman. So you have to do this. So, yeah, because I'm with the local church at almost all times, I don't really feel a fear.
Ryan, did you have anything? And then Dominic. And
so you had mentioned that some communities don't do this at all.
Right.
And I was just curious, is there any kind of determiner factor that influences whether a community will do FGM, or like, is it a level of remoteness or anything, or is it just kind of arbitrary?
Great question. Some of it is remoteness, I think. Many of the groups that do it in Tanzania are over on the Arusha side, and our side are cattle herders, and it is much more remote. A lot of lack of education. There's a strong polygamy in the area. Men can marry many wives. That's all those things.
Can I just have a follow-up question? Is it diversity within ethnic groups, or is it that some ethnic groups practice it and some don't?
Oh, it's definitely not practiced by everybody. There's only 15% in Tanzania. In Kenya, it's about 55%.
Are there groups within an ethnic group that don't practice it, and some that do? That's my question.
Yeah. I'm trying to think in our area, the main ethnic group that does it is the Kuria, and it's all the subclans of them that do it also. But there are a few clans in it that I've heard have quit. Huh. So it can be done. I think it has a lot to do with the elders in your area. If they kind of say yes, they say no, whatever. Yeah. Very influenced by that.
Dominic and Marianne.
I was just wondering how we could increase awareness in American Catholic parishes, because I went to Catholic school in my life, elementary school and high school, and I never spoke about this, and I just learned about this last year, but a lot of my friends back home in New York aren't studying theology or are not too involved in their faith as much as they should be. And I think, like, if we let people know about this early on, maybe they'll be inspired to get involved in lay ministry.
I'm going to throw back to the group because I'm, Lay Ministry. Yeah, we got to get people speaking more. I mean, that definitely. I was going to say about the gender stuff, I think you could all answer that better than I could. But Lay Ministry, yeah, it's really inviting people. That's kind of the words I've used a lot of times is come and see, you know, come and look and go on these immersion trips. Get these students out. And most of our lay ministers that have come from this area have gone through Boston College and the immersion trips. And so they've experienced touching the poor someplace. And now they come out for the 3.5-year contract, the first contract. So it's really getting people out. And I do a lot with different groups that come out and make sure that if I can get into the group when it's out there to speak with them and just kind of share my own story or what we're doing again and constantly say I'm a Marino lay missioner. You know, and then usually somebody comes and says, what is that? You know, I never heard of that. And that's fine. Some of them keep talking about it. Yeah, but you have to remember we're in a Jesuit area.
Right. And because a lot of my friends back home will say, well, the Catholic Church isn't doing enough or, you know, they're not too involved, but this is extraordinary work.
Right. So you started on a... Oh, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Oh, go ahead, please.
You say you started on a 3.5-year contract?
My first one was, yeah. Now I've done 40 years, so yeah. I really came, I went out thinking 3.5 years. The five people with me all thought, this is life, we're going to do it forever. They were home in 3 years. I was thinking, you guys are nuts, I'm going home. I'm the one. So God makes other plans while we're making our plans, huh?
Liz, it's kind of two questions, I think. One is about... some of us in this room and others, of course, were involved in how an international campaign to end child soldiering, for
mm-hmm,
example.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit the question, like, what can we be part of? So is there kind of a momentum for an international campaigning where some of us who are sort of arm's length can
mm-hmm.
actually play a role? And secondly, and I don't know that it's my ignorance, but, like, is it helpful to put FGM and child marriage together, or are we looking at two related topics
mm-hmm.
or two different topics? You know, I'm just trying to understand that bit
as
well.
It's two, they're related, but they're different.
Mm.
So they do need to be separated out if you're doing any of these projects. The UN had a huge project the last couple of years on FGM to end it.
Mm.
I don't feel it got out to the masses in the same way. But I know a number of years back they had one on obstetric fistula,
mm-hmm.
and I was very involved with it. I mean, I came back here and spoke at the UN to different groups and stuff.
Yeah.
So they were much more out there.
Yeah.
The FGM one's been going on, but I haven't heard much about it.
No.
So, but it would be the child soldiers, same thing.
Yeah.
But think of the link with the child soldiers. All those girls that were taken have all been child marriages in with the military.
Mm.
So they're all linked. And so how do you keep bringing it into it, I guess? Or maybe it gets too complex for people.
That's what I'm trying to understand. In one sense, I'm trying to put it like a gendered analysis as to why there's international child soldier, there's the one about children in detention.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get to FGM, you've moved into a woman's role, a woman's agenda thing. I'm wondering whether there's a reluctance because of the area of sexuality, of gender, that doesn't have these... go. And the one that you mentioned earlier, the medicos led that one, and it has, you know, so kind of I'm just trying to understand why some campaigns or might be sort of more able to take off than others. But I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to
Sometimes I think it's also the tradition. And I get that thrown at me more than anything is how can you go in and change tradition?
Yeah, and I think that was the question.
Yeah. In many ways it's right. I mean, we have to be very sensitive to that, but you have to be working with the people within. But yet on this side, we need the advocates on this side that are going to help us do that, you know? But getting involved in any of these, just learning more about it, and there's so much interconnectedness to me. It's hard to sort through it.
Yeah, no, thanks.
Yeah, let's do one last. Carrie.
One last question. But you could answer this either in terms of being a lay missionary or in terms of working with these sorts of issues. What would you say are the 3 or 4 top mistakes that people make in trying to address these issues, or in being a lay missionary?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Do I have another hour or what?
We'll let you listen. 7 part
wow.
question, 7 part answer.
Yeah, 7 part answer.
Because we have a lot of students who go and do maybe a year with JVC or 2 year with international JVC. And or, you know, former students who are, you know, with the Marinoles. But, you know, and I always want to say to them, good luck and don't do this, or, you know, or, I mean, you know.
I can learn.
Yeah, how, what are the kinds of mistakes that that are sort of, you make in your first 3 years?
When you're out there.
Your contract.
One of them for me is they come out, kids come out, and they want to go to the level that I'm at right now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I'm 40 years to move to this point where I'm at. And that's taken a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to do that. But there are many areas for me that they should be starting at, which is just be with the people. Listen to the stories. Listen to the, you know, the girls that have fistula or these girls in the shelter. And just come and start working with reading and writing, you know, help them move forward. Now, it's not as maybe glamorous. Yeah, you know, and people want to get into all the, you know. I also, if you look at everything as how good is it going to look on my resume? Boy, that irritates me. People come out and say to me, I need to do this so that my resume looks better. And we'll say to them, you know, we'd really like you to work in this area. You know, you've got the skills for it. Oh, no, that's that won't look good on my resume, but I need to do that. And you go, yeah. So I've seen that. Marianne, you must have some too from people.
I love your first point. I think it's brilliant what you said, don't get to where I am immediately, you know, like, but I think I was concerned when you spoke earlier about, when we spoke about emotions, because I have really mixed thoughts about short-term emotions. Mm-hmm. So when you said that, I thought, oh, there's a positive to an emotion, that they actually see something that they can return to. But I'm really often concerned about the debriefing, because I see kids here with CVs and they'll say, oh, you know, and I've worked in the Philippines or I've been here and I've been there.
Yeah.
And it's been for 2 weeks. It's like, you've got that on your CV. You know, like it's, so it's kind of the humility bits where I'm kind of.
I agree with you. Debriefing is really, really important and working. I think you have to work with people all the time. I ran a guest house at one point in my life. I had a full-time job, too. I don't think I've ever done anything without the side jobs on it, but I was working at this huge hospital at Bugando in 800 beds, doing all this other work, but I brought in visiting doctors. And, well, I didn't. The hospital was bringing them in. But they stayed with me, and they ate with me every night. And so every night, we basically spent dinner debriefing what they had experienced that day. And they probably didn't really get it because they were just there for that month. But for me, it was, you know, night after night after night of debriefing these people from what they had experienced that day, or how the trauma maybe of whatever the medical was going on that day. And I really, at the end of it, people, after they had been gone a while, would write back and say, those evening meals got me through it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very conscious point on our side to do it that way, but most times people didn't know we were doing it until after.
Mm.
So it's really important to have someone with them to walk and accompany. I push kids to journal through whatever they're doing. You've got to be journaling. You've got to be writing it down. You can go back to it later and say, what happened in this? I also tell people, don't give up your hobby or whatever it is if it's you're capable of doing it. I learned to paint. I watercolor, I oil paint because of my post-traumatic stress that I went through from living in the Sudan in the war. You know, I had to bring out that side, you know. So bring out your creative side, but keep doing something so you don't leave here and leave everything at home, you know. Read. You know, some of our young lay missionaries come out, they don't read anything. I'm handing them stuff all the time. Others come out and I can't get them out of their book. They're kind of like me, you know, which is great. But, you know, you need to be reading and keeping up on, you know, what's happening. So.
Can I just add an unsolicited point, which with our undergrads here especially,
You don't have to, it's not either become Liz Mock or nothing. Mm. And I think there's this messianic view that you're going to go in and you're going to do an incredible thing in 3 years and 6 months. And if you don't do that, you might as well just forget it and go to Wall Street. Because there's a lot of ways to help. There's a lot of gender-based violence here. There's a lot of consciousness raising here. A lot of work needs to be done here. And you got to figure out where can I do it effectively. And it's not for your whole life, but where can I do concretely the good possible to me? So anyway.
Some people jump
hear you
in
and they want to go, I could never do that, you know, back to accounting. And it doesn't have to be either or.
And just jump in. I often tell students out in Minnesota that if you're doing nothing here, you will do nothing overseas. So you need to be doing whatever you want to do overseas, you need to be doing it here. And if you do it here, you'll understand the issues so much more, and you'll be able to apply it over there. But if you haven't done anything here, you're coming out on vacation for me. Might as well be on a safari in the Serengeti, you know? Which is good, too.
Yes, Andrea.
Good, huh?
Yeah.
Can you ask something about maybe some insights or positive lessons that you learn interacting with the key figures in that cultural setting that are the elders and the women encounters? Mm-hmm. Because these are persons who could become different, who could lead, who help that, let's say, have a role of leadership in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And if you think that our cultural context, we are struggling in having to interact with some leaders who don't give a damn about anything. Mm. So somehow, and it seems that the personal interaction is what might help to go toward the change more than campaigns that are all over the world. But there it is, once an area it happens and the other area nearby doesn't happen. So there is something there that needs to be transformed. And there are interlocutors. And there are social agents who have a role in leadership who can be become partners or resisting to change. Mm-hmm. So because you have lived there for 40 years. So if there are some insights that you can give us in our own context when we think about shaping leaders or dealing with leaders who are not caring for the common good.
Yeah. Great. I think when I look at what we do, one of the things very much is a listening role. When we start a seminar to try to make change with people, we don't go in with people start lecturing. We start with where they're at, and we start with, you tell us, what are the cultural difficulties you have? And it's going to come up in that. And we spend at least 3 days doing that in a seminar, a four-day seminar, just getting what do they think are the issues and getting them in small groups and talking about it. So, and it always comes up. FGM and these child marriages always come up at some point. So we know it'll be there, or we'll get it in there. And then on the fourth day is when we really kind of go at it. But up until that point, we've really been just listening to them and hearing so that we're not telling. Because I think what happens in most places is we're always telling, where you need to change, you need to do this. But we need to go in and listen better. And I do that with students a lot. I tell them, ask the questions. I'm amazed at some of the questions I've been asked. It's obvious they're listening or they're hearing other things. Help me out. What else are you thinking of? Come on, Marianne.
No,
would know more.
I was listening. It's a great question,
yeah.
And I'm wondering whether we need all the. I was wondering whether we need the social agents, the change agents, who are inspirational. But I think we also need. I was thinking back to the campaign whether we also need some momentum that kind of takes their word or their insight with them around, people who are not hands-on engaged in this area but are maybe interested in gender equality or something like that. So I was trying to work out, I almost was, we need all aspects.
Right.
And then I was thinking, this is just a question, because you were talking about funding and about shelters and the issue of how to kind of exit young women so that they can actually do something else. And one of the things, responses that I know is probably one that a lot of people do, which is to give money. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to work out how you kind of harness the best of all of that, but have people being aware and reading into and knowing the topic as well. So I kind of was thinking it needs to be a really big levels of response,
mm-hmm.
but they need to be joined up,
mm-hmm.
was what I was thinking. But I like the social agents
mm-hmm.
bit big time.
In addition to what you said last night,
mm-hmm.
women cutters earn money.
Yes.
So if they're not cutting anymore, they need to find another way in which they can earn money and support their families.
Yeah.
About the elders, I guess it's the issue of authority.
Mm-hmm.
So if we take away from them the possibility to decide about the family
right.
women that we pick up,
mm-hmm.
we need to find another way in which we preserve their authority, you know, leading a symbolic rite of passage, whatever, so that they are still the elders,
mm-hmm.
and we don't undermine the leadership,
mm-hmm.
but we are not harming women to do that.
Yeah.
Or it's not connected. We separate the connection between the fact that women need to become women, the girls need to become women,
mm-hmm.
and it will happen, and the elders play a role in this, but not not with the cutting.
Mm-hmm.
So this world, from the point of view of an outsider, things that resonate in my mind while I was listening to you.
I was just wondering, though, at the very beginning about, is this something that in a couple of generations we'll be having such a different conversation because of media and telephones and about education? I'm just wondering whether where globalization or whatever we call
mm-hmm.
it fits in this as well.
Education.
Now, is that going to happen anyway? Which I don't want it to just happen anyway, but people are going to take on different occupations and things.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Well, at the same time, no. There are elements that can be controlled and others that cannot be controlled. So we cannot control what will happen to the Tanzanian society in Tanzania in the future. But we can play a role of these destructive or constructive. So there it is to preserve the structures of that society, but you know, making them more respectful of human rights.
Yes.
And then there would be a transition. Okay, this would be a next step, but you know, because you know, we want to remove that harming of women
mm-hmm.
without you know
putting
just
stuff.
Breaking
all the
elements of society.
Yeah.
So leadership could be converted, and there are examples in other parts of the world where leadership has been preserved, but it has been transformed, so there is no harm involved. There are still roles that are working for society.
But if you're really getting at the issue of the equality of men and women, it's going to break the male hold on power and authority and status. It can't help but do it.
Yeah, but you can say the elders could be also women. So equality
that's pretty radical change.
A transformation within, let's say, some structure that are there, they are only transformed,
mm-hmm.
modified,
mm-hmm.
or made more equal.
Right.
But then who knows?
Yeah.
Well, this has provided a double conversation here between an extraordinary conversation about your work in East Africa and about FGM in particular, but also a marvelous conversation about social change and about accompaniment
mm-hmm.
and best practices. I just want to remind you, we've recorded this and we'll put the audio online in case you want to store this in your memory banks or use it to inform yourself or re-inform yourself or inform your students and colleagues as well. But most importantly, we want to thank you, Liz, for the work you do and for being here today to share it with us. And I hope you'll come back.
Thank you.
Thank you all. There's food in the kitchen.
Thanks, Sarah.
Of course.
For sponsoring.